We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain-sensing headband that helps you meditate and sleep, and Meditation Studio, the five-star app. I'm Patricia Karpis. As always, we invite you to check out the Muse brain-sensing headband at choosemuse.com. It's an amazing tool if you want to start or deepen your meditation practice and get a good night's sleep. It's all there. Use Untangle 15 for your discount. Today's guest is Dr. Tobias Esch, a primary care physician, pioneer in holistic general medicine, and expert in the neurobiology of happiness. He shaped mind-body medicine and integrative health in Germany and as a visiting professor at Harvard Medical School and associate neuroscientist at the State University of New York. He's published more than 300 scientific works. His background is in primary care, neurobiology, and positive psychology, and the focus of his work has been on promoting good health and wellness, patient activation, and behavior change. In this interview, we dive into his happiness model and what he calls the U-curve of happiness, which is, you'll find, both surprising and fascinating. The good news is that happiness can be shaped through practice, and he'll share how. He does provide a distinction between life satisfaction and happiness, though they're both deep feeling states, but they are defined differently. His wisdom is cultivated through a rich blend of neuroscience, neurobiology, medicine, positive psychology, mindfulness, gratitude, stillness, and acceptance. He believes in listening deeply and connecting with his patients to uncover what might be beyond the obvious. Now, here's Tobias. Tobias, thank you so much for being on Untangle today. We're thrilled to have you.
Thank you. I'm thrilled too.
You have written a lot about the neuroscience and the neurobiology of pretty big things like happiness and love. And I like to begin by trying to understand what brought you to this place. Tell us a little bit about maybe what you were like as a 10-year-old and how you became so interested in the science and researching all of these really important subjects in our lives.
Yeah. So how many minutes you give me? No. Okay. Let's start here. I grew up in a household with my father being a physician. He was a director of a clinic, and my mother was a Well, actually, medical student when she met him, and then later became a nurse. So medicine and the question of life and death and how to make sense to all of this, that was always a big question. And then there was the question, what are the limitations of medicine? Because I learned my father coming home quite often being desperate almost, or at least depressed because he could not help patients. So I also learned that there is the beauty about medicine, like the fascination about science and how we humans actually function. But then there was also always the question of, what if not? What if we cannot heal? How does that feel? So I was fascinated by that. And there was always this little voice telling me, don't go into medicine because you just don't want to walk the same path that your father did. It's just too easy. It just appeared to me to be too boring to just do the same what my father did. So I basically said, I go where it's really hard to keep up with the wish or the idea to become a medical doctor because it's so hard and you learn so much about medicine not really functioning so that you will get rid of this idea of becoming a doctor. So I just finished high school at the age of 18 and went into a clinic for oncology patients. So I worked as a nurse, we call it assistant nurse, for 2 years in a ward where my first day morning, 6 o'clock, started with opening the door of a room with six women, no hairs, and switching on the light and washing. So this is how my medical career started, and I really got into a very deep dip of asking myself about death and dying and what is the meaning of all of this. So I almost got rid of the idea of becoming a doctor. And then one morning I woke up, went into the clinic, and I was like the happiest person on earth. I don't really know what happened, but I felt that I, for myself, have found not a solution, but a way to approach medicine as a whole, including the fact that medicine quite often would not heal, but just support. And that place was that I learned that medicine is the ticket to sit on the bed of a patient and listen and learn and really connect to the person. So I learned that medicine is an invitation, almost a sacred invitation, to be very intimate in a listening in a human way with someone and be able to learn and to incorporate what is actually beyond the medical record. So that the medical record is just a tool and the medical profession almost just being a tool to really meet people in their truest and most authentic way. And when I understood that, I was so fascinated. And so my journey, that's the last piece to add, then otherwise the answer gets too long. But what I was fascinated by was, I was there working as a nurse, and the doctors came in when they had their rounds, and like 1, 2, 3, 5, the chief of department, the deputy, the assistant doctors, the residents, the nurses, all of them in, blah, 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 blah. And I was in the room with the patient who had just been crying with me. Patient stopped crying, said, yes, no, no, yes, yes, no, no, yes. And then everybody went and left again. And the patient and I would just continue our conversation where we have left it. And I thought, I know so much more about these people than you all know. You have in your charts about the heart frequency and the lab work and about when they had stool the last time. All fine, but I know when was the last time when they have loved, when they were crying, why they get up for it, what inspires them. I knew all of this, and I said, or felt, this is important for medicine. Medicine needs to know these things, not only because they are interesting, but I always felt they might be important for the cause of a disease, or even someone dying, the question of happily or not happily, or maybe not happily, but being okay when dying. This question, I thought, that is so important. And I was excited and determined to help this become a part of medicine. And so it was easy. Then there it started.
It's incredible and beautiful. And I understand a little bit of what inspired you to get to that place. But once you were there sitting in front of a patient who might be dying or who you were trying to tap into their suffering or the humanity underneath their suffering, How did that feel for you? And what were the practices that you needed to do so that you didn't come home like your father, depressed or sad, or this feeling that you might not be able to help people in a way that they might be helped?
So on the practice side, I started meditating quite early in my, I think, at the age of 15 or 16, but I wouldn't say that meditation was really the helper. It was something else. That was basically accepting. I think that's basically it. Accepting that I have to be able to look into the mirror and be fine with how things are. So the basic idea that I learned when I was working with these patients who quite many of them actually died during the time I was with them. When I started and I was struggling for a couple of months, really hard struggling, because I felt here's this patient walking into the ward and I could almost see them not leaving again and dying. And so I had this feeling, this could be me. So I could be lying there and I could be dying next week or whatever. And what is it? Why am I here if this is all? And what will I leave behind? Is there any reason? Is there any purpose, any meaning? And then I had this idea that it somehow occurred to me, and this is a basic Buddhist teaching, one could say, but I was not coming from the intellectual part. I was really working myself through it, which was, so what? I don't know about what's to come. What I do know is I am here. Life is real. And this moment is real. And this moment, supposedly, I will not die. So skip all the concepts, all the love letters in the shelf and all this question, the diary, everything. Skip it just now, just here. Enjoy this moment. Be happy. This person who's going to die is alive now. It's unfair to treat him or her as a person who's going to die and be suffering and sad about all of this because he's living in this moment. Why don't we share this moment together, two beings being alive, no matter what comes? So there was this moment of realizing that it is about relationship. It is about relating to people, meeting people, and not about the concept what was and what is going to come. And with that practice, which you could call a Buddhist or a mindfulness practice, but it's basically the taking out everything that is not real, that is not now, everything that is a projection or a concept, put that away and just be here and be attentive and present. And with that, what helped? I would go into the ward. I would see suffering, people crying, all of it. I would be fully into it and I would leave the ward and I would go dancing. I would enjoy. I would see my friends. My answer, my practice was life itself. And not overdoing it, not carpe diem, like overdoing, like this is my last minute and I just spent everything. No, the practice was doing things that I enjoy and that relating to people, go out, party, everything. But in the mindset of someone who knows that this is a very precious time and I wanted to go for long, like really long, but if not, I can say this is the moment and this is real. And so practice was happiness, actually happiness. That was the answer.
It's a gift that you had. And when you think about it, it sounds like you had an inner philosophy that was just really a part of who you are and who you were that gave you this gift of being able to be with people in these moments and then not take it on as you left, but rather appreciate that you have this gift of life. And I love that you said your practice was life itself. In some ways, you're able to compartmentalize so that you could live your life in the most full way.
Yeah.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. We talk about these often on Untangle. When we keep things bottled up inside, it can start to impact our health mentally, emotionally, and physically. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, whatever it is. If this sounds like you, and it's a bit of all of us, Give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule and needs. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now over to untangle.
Yes, and I then later became a medical student. And my idea was then, and that is to jump into all those years that follows, and then what I'm doing now, we will possibly talk about it. But the basic idea was, what is an obstacle to that attitude or that realizing or living fully for myself and scientifically for us as humans? What would decrease this possibility and what would facilitate, what would support it? And if so, if that can be studied and can it be trained? That's the second question. And the third question is, would that have an effect even to medicine, to healing and care? So these questions were actually, I started my medical career with those questions. Is, let's call it happiness. Is it real? Second, is it my private thing or is it a general potential? Third, can it be trained and learned? And then fourth, would it make a difference to the course of diseases, for example, and then basically become part of medicine one day? So that is what brought me where I then ended up.
It's fascinating. And the articles that I've read don't seem to take it to that level of how would it help in medicine. But I want to get to that place because you have proposed a model for how do we explore happiness from a neurobiological perspective. And maybe from that question, we can try to understand, how do you even define happiness in a neurobiological way?
Yeah, maybe if we have time, we can even come to the point how to apply to medicine, because the articles you read are covering certain aspects. One is happiness, as we will talk in a second. Yet, I wrote a textbook which became number one medical textbook in, I think, even Europe, well, German-speaking countries, but by the numbers, even in Europe, that has the title, The Neurobiology of Happiness in German, and the subtitle is How Positive Psychology Would Change Medicine. And this is all about applying this to medicine. And we do it. I founded a clinic here in Germany on a primary care clinic, which is working integratively. And patients who come here with any diseases from primary care, they do learn exactly these tools to apply them into their daily life. So I had not stopped at the point of the neuroscience, but really was eager to get this into the mainstream medicine. So we did this, but this has also been published in some scientific papers. But the actual work, the mind-body medicine, the work we do, the most of it here in Germany is written in German. So that's why you couldn't find it.
I did look at some of those books and I don't read in German, unfortunately.
But yeah, so happiness. What we did, as I studied medicine, but I was always interested in who tells me as a medical doctor and then the primary care doctor that I became, who tells me that I'm not eligible to also study the brain and the receptors and the molecule? Who says that? Who says that a primary care physician could not also be a neuroscientist? And then on the other hand, who says that a neuroscientist who understood a bit about the brain should not go into medicine and apply it to real patients with real conditions? So I never accepted this, which in the US you have less. However, in Germany, you have it more, that one should only stick to what his business card says. I always said, no, I'm traveling between these professions because I think nobody says it's not allowed. And because in Germany, it's quite uncommon. So I went to Boston, to Harvard, to the US the first time between 2000 and 2002 to go work with Herb Benson at the Mind Body Medical Institute to really learn the whole history and the application and the science actually between the mind-body connection and meditation and relaxation response and all these things. And then I went a second time as a professor, as a visiting professor between 2013 and 2015 to learn more about the application of these things into medicine and then to carry all of this back home here to Germany. And in the meantime, I was associated, luckily, with a neuroscience lab in New York where we studied the reward system in the brain and endogenous morphine, all these neurotransmitters that are part of reward and motivation and basically of happiness. So what we learned or what we came up with is what I called a model, or the model maybe, of the neurobiology of happiness, which says, basing on the science of the reward system, we distinct three types of motivation and, if you want, so happiness. One is the short-lived, more ecstatic thrill that happens when you really want something, you aspire to, you're really up to something, you're excited, you will do a bungee jump or you will do something really thrilling. And that moment of pleasure and lust, that is one type. We call it type A, which is short-lived, but very physical, can see it and feel it in the whole body. Other neurotransmitters and other parts of the brain being involved here. Then the second one, which is, we call it type B, which is when you don't want to have something, but you want to avoid something. Not you want to go where somewhere, you want to have appetite, you want to approach, but you want to run away, you want to avoid, you have aversion. That is the opposite, you could say, almost, of the first state, which is particularly linked to the stress hormones in the brain and the areas that are involved here. And then, which was, I think, the first time that someone has put out a third state, because approach and aversion, that had been known before, but we were distincting a third feeling or a third state of happiness, which would be not wanting to have something or not wanting to avoid something, but being happy with things as they are. Don't want to go and don't want to go away, but just want to stay. And this feeling of being happy with how things are, a deep contentment, a deep feeling, an inner feeling of happiness, which would be much less pronounced, much less physical, much less thrilling, but and less dependent on outer rewards or outer aspirations, but more like an inner arriving, a state of arriving at one's own door, meeting oneself and being happy with what is, harvesting what had been done before. And this state also being in the moment when the brain, the stress decreases, there's a state of quiescence, of connectedness. Also, the feeling of connectedness over generations, transcendence, also almost like a spiritual state. We could point that and pin down in the brain and find the reward mechanisms there and the neurotransmitters there and the areas. So now comes the clue. This is type C. So we found these three different types. And then we looked at the evolution, when which neurotransmitter actually appeared. And we found a fascinating link, as I think, that one neurotransmitters, the ones that are more involved in this type A, this ecstasy aspiring part, which is, for example, dopamine. If dopamine comes with type B, with stress hormones, then the biochemistry, the biochemical mechanism we described, then at the end, endogenous morphine or endogenous opiates are produced as a chain, like a biochemical chain. And then the whole system is calming down, this cascade of events from wanting to have, stress is finally coming to an end, and one becomes happy and content. We could give evidence that there is a logic between type A, B, and C, and one follows the other. One is the consequence of the other. So if you have much of that aspiration, ecstasy, wanting to have, and you get it, but it's stressful, like really hard, finally you arrive, you get more of this feeling of contentment. And then last part, since these different states follow each other, we put out the theory already in 2011 that you would find them during different phases in life, different stages in life, more pronounced than in others. Meaning the wanting to have, the growing, the thrill, the ecstasy part being particularly prone and happening in the young, the part where life is hard, where happiness is actually more the relief from pain, from stress, the moment when stress pauses, more in the middle life, the midlife crisis. And then when you feel arriving, your ship harboring and looking upon your life and being happy with all that happened in your life and being grateful more in the elderly. So there was this idea of ABC also representing three big portions or phases in life, with happiness in the young being thrilling and pronounced, but you can't hold it. It will disappear. It will vanish because one event follows the next, follows the next, follows the next. And then the midlife crisis, where happiness is more just surviving. And then the deep contentment, where happiness would be more a trait than a fluctuating state. And with that, we put out the theory that maybe if this is really true, if this is really true, and if you apply it to real life, then the most happy would be the elderly. And when we put out this theory, we thought ourselves, oh gosh, that's not true. That is not how we look at the elderly. They are sick, they have diseases, they can't look, they don't smell nice, they lost their partners, they have pain. And these should be the happiest because of your strange theory. That doesn't work. And so I sat there and said, well, I don't know. I don't have the data. Until 2015, I was having this visiting professorship, and I had the chance to meet the people who were working on the Harvard Nurses Health Study, which was, or is still until today, one of the longest and biggest study that ever looked at also quality of life and subjective mental states of people, started with nurses and then later also male nurses and then their partners being added over more than 40 years, and 200,000 people looked at. And so I said, wow, gosh, now we have the chance to look at this model. And I asked the colleagues, what measures were applied in the studies? And then there's one that is very famous for quality of life. And I knew that this has a more physical part, looking at the body, like pain and diseases of the body. And it has a subjective, more mental or psyche sum score, where you look at the feeling of people, how the psychological state. And I said, can we look at those two distinct from each other? And then the colleague said, why? Because if people get older, they get more diseases, their quality of life sinks. It goes down. It decreases. We know this. This is the data. Here, you look at it. I said, yeah, but what if we distinct the body part from the mind part? And they said, why? They will be the same. Of course, if people are more sick, more pain, they will be unhappy. So why do that? I said, well, I have an idea. Just do it. So they did it, and we analyzed it, and here you go. While the physical sum score went down over life, the psychological, the mental state went up. And there was a crossing point, which I call the valley of tears in the midlife, as our model had predicted. And from that on, like in the middle of the 40s, while the physical sum score on how life is goes down, how it feels, how happy you are, goes up. And that was the point where I found, wow, this is real. It's real. And now, to shorten it, now this, which is called the U-curve of happiness now, and they call it also the happiness paradoxon, because it's paradox that people will be happier when objectively everything speaks against it, but subjectively feel better and better. This is why it's called the satisfaction or happiness paradoxon or paradox. Yeah, long story. This is where we ended up, that actually when people get older, the idea of always being healthy and healed and come back to the state of like early life when you were complete and whole and everything physically, that when people realize they won't get there again anymore, they will stay sick. 2/3 of the people being 65 and older have two diseases that will never go away, chronic diseases. So the reality of people above 60 is that most of them are chronically sick and will never get completely healthy. And if physical health is a requirement for happiness, then all of those would get sad. And the opposite is true. People, when they get older, they evolve from the idea of the body being the place of happiness. They go into what we call transcendence, or whatever you want to call it. They emancipate themselves from relying on the body. And this is, you asked me how I came into medicine. I always felt it. I always felt if medicine is limited, and God, it's not. I'm so happy that I'm a physician. I studied all of this and I have the clinic here and I'm a big fan of medicine in the conventional way. But yes, there are limitations. Let's talk about them. And is it possible to become or stay or really get even happier, even when you're sick and maybe at one day have to realize that you're going to have to die? And can you stay with yourself? Can you look into the mirror as you are today in this moment and be happy? If that is possible, wouldn't that be cool as part of medicine? And yeah, so this is what drove me to that point.
It's fascinating. I mean, the whole idea of the satisfaction paradox and the U-curve. And as you said, happened for yourself, this idea, it sounds like in that third cohort of older people, there is this measure of acceptance so that you come to terms with the fact that you may not be as healthy as you once were. And there's a settledness into what is true for you now.
There is one really interesting question. So if you look at the paradox or the U-curve, and yes, it is true that one learning is obviously there's a lot of acceptance. So people, when they get older, they, you could say, get realistic and they accept and then make sense of it, make meaning of it and still be happy. Now comes an interesting thought experiment. If this would be all, if it's just about accepting, wouldn't then the happiness level just stay equal level, just be on one even level, like would not grow further? Because what you do is the less reasons for being happy objectively, you accept and you cope. And as the result, you just will stay happy as much or good as you were before. That would link also to what some colleagues call the happiness set point theory, that there is a happiness set point and you undulate around it, but you always come back to it, which is also one definition of resiliency, that you're able to just recover and come back. Now the thought experiment, if that is all, or if that was all, then happiness would be more like a flat curve, which would be exciting still. However, what we found, not only us, now many, many colleagues around the world, actually just last year published in 141 countries showing the same pattern. What we found is that happiness is actually growing beyond or above youth levels and where it ever was in the 60 and 65 and older people, even until the 80, 84, 85, growing and still increasing. So if it is increasing above levels, it could not just be acceptance, because we actually grow in happiness. We not just stay and accept, we grow. So what we then did, this is how I, you asked how I would be thinking and how my pattern of as a scientist works. So I said, so if there is a growing component, not just an acceptance component, which there is, I guess. But if there is more than just acceptance, but because of this thought experiment, there is a growth component to it.
A word from our sponsor, Happy Mammoth. This is the company that created the amazing supplement, Hormone Harmony, and they are dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients like herbal extracts called adaptogens that help the body adapt to any stressors, especially those chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. They're offering our listeners 15% off the first order at happymammoth.com using the promo code UNTANGLE. So if you're tired of hot flashes, night sweats, low moods, poor sleep, you get the drill. The things that put your life on hold, you will want to check them out. For a limited time, you can get 15% off on your entire first order at happymammoth.com. with the code UNTANGLE at checkout. That's happymammoth.com with the code UNTANGLE. Now, on to UNTANGLE.
Study people who could tell us more about this in a very pronounced way. This would be people that have a life trajectory which would be cut off due to some significant life event. And from that one event on, their U curve or whatever curve would be completely disrupted. And they need to find some meaning to their life, as we all have to when we get older. So I said, who are the people besides the elderly who could tell us more about this potential of our human brain and us as humans? And I thought, well, let's look at people who actually had an accident and sit in the wheelchair because of that. Because let's start with a group of people that would be like an expert group for how to cope when things are not as they used to be. And so we started studying people who sit in a wheelchair after an accident. And these studies are still ongoing. But what I can say so far already is there is, one would call it post-traumatic growth. I would say it's there is the potential for thriving and growth in crisis or due to crisis that is deeply human. And it's a potential that we all seem to have to make meaning. But then when something really significant happens and hurts us and strikes us, not only to accept, but actually to take this as a starting point to really grow and learn so much about us that at the end, we are happier with what we have gone through than without, which is, I know, a very cynical point, but I was very hesitant saying that. But I heard so many of our study subjects saying, with this accident I had, I learned so much. I'm so happy. And I'm now in a wheelchair. And I know physically I'm not free anymore. But inside, I feel so free. I'm even thankful. And I never wished for this to happen. But if you take this away, but take away what I learned about myself and life, I would rather stay in the wheelchair because I don't want to miss that anymore. I heard this on and on. We're still in the study, so I can't give the final results, but it's not just acceptance. It is about growth and eliciting the human potential.
Eliciting the human potential. I feel that we've talked a lot about the philosophy and stages, if you will, of happiness. You talk about it as biological. And I'm curious about biological versus lifestyle and age. But you also say that even though it's biological in this context that you discuss, it can still be learned. And that's where you begin talking about how happiness can be shaped through practice, and contemplative practices can serve as an example of how we can demonstrate this trainability and influence the course of happiness. And you talked about life itself being a practice for you, and you do meditation, but you also learned about these deep connections and the acceptance of life just as it is. But what are some practices or some ways that happiness can be shaped for people at any age, like not just looking at the different age cohorts that you suggested, but let's look at a 20-year-old who's struggling with the struggles of a 20-year-old post-teen years. And what are the practices that help people find their own set point of happiness?
So first of all, given the fact that, as I said, that there are these three different dimensions, you could almost say, of happiness, which is like the going out there, being free, being autonomous, learning and don't care. And then there is this, wow, life is really difficult. And make sure that at one point during your day, you can close your door and just take off the shoes and just be have a moment of peace. And then there is this transcendent state where you are actually coming to terms and become quiescent or quiet and feel related and feel like the broader relationship, the we, and not just the me or the I or having to protect and to fight, but take down the defense and the arm mechanism and just be. So first of all three ABC portions, they are right. All of them are good. All of them are healthy. I would even say live all of them fully, because biologically, one leads to the other. So enjoy life. Go out. Don't care. Well, of course you care. But in terms of challenge yourself and be creative and really go there where you can feel happiness, knowing that you cannot hold it. And then the practice of stress management. And when life is really difficult, let it be difficult. The most important thing is try to keep within the parameters of you can deal with it. Try to keep within the parameters, not overdoing it as a young to be so risky that you die, not being so much stressed out that you end up being totally burnt out and not being able to function at all. And as like an older or elderly person, if you are content and happy and thankful, what we hear from so many people, share it. Share it. Don't make it a private thing. Tell the people, because the question one could ask, why is it so? Why are there these three different stages? And why are the elderly the happiest? Does that make any sense? Maybe it does. Because at one point in life, we need to go. We need to let go. We need to die. And if the message that we all would get, that getting elder is just something that you hate, something that you don't want to have, something which is not only difficult, but actually disastrous, and the place of having to die is like really the end. It feels like a dead end. If that is the message, who would want to live? And like Viktor Frankl and other people who study meaning and all of that said, one of the greatest human achievement is to make sense and meaning in the tragedy, to give purpose and meaning to suffering, and then finally to dying. So I believe all three phases, they're exactly how they should be, and at the place in life where they have their significance. And the third one, the elderly being content, but more quiet, having a feeling of the we, is also the we in terms of intergenerational, being connected to your grandchildren. Share it, the wisdom you achieved. Be the elderly, be the holder of the tradition, the one that needs to give the blessings, as in many cultures, the elderly, the wise old lady, the wise old man, the one who is like the chief of the tribe. Be that and share it and tell them your wisdom, what you have learned, even if they will laugh at you. But there is always this feeling that this is so important. Be a role model. So what one can actively do, first of all, stay within your trajectory. Don't overdo it. And if you're sick or you need help or it's just too much or you're overburdened, or get help. That's one thing. Second, there are practices which are studies have shown on and on and on, which are quite easy and learnable to be taught and applied. First of all, exercise. Be physically active, because that the reward system, which plays all this, the reward system is the toolbox for all of this. This needs to be trained. The reward system constantly needs to have experiences and be challenged and then pay reward for things that actually are pleasurable or relieving or really deeply happy. So get out there. And one of it is exercise, at least 30 minutes a day. Just get out there and practice and feel the body, feel connected to the ground you run on. Then mindfulness. Mindfulness being coming to your senses, coming into the moment and really live it fully and have your reward system tell you that you are living fully. Feel that you're alive here and now, whatever you encounter. Welcome whatever is. So mindful eating, for example, we use it in a lot with our patients, the mindfulness being applied as a meditation practice, or, for example, with eating and healthy eating. And then there is meditation in general. Have moments during your life, your daily life, where you just be with yourself and be able to accept what is and to be happy with what is. Meditation as a way to reduce stress, which would alter the brain and leave you being more resilient and stress resistant, so that this critical middle age phase particularly will not hurt you so much. And then there is the, as I call it sometimes, the Champions League discipline, which would be positive psychology, or have a diary for what you're happy, happiness diary. Have a diary for what you're grateful for, what you're thankful for. If you meet someone who smiled at you, don't take this for granted. Realize it, remember it, memorize it. If you have something that bothers you, that sits in your mind and makes you ruminate, write about it, express it. All what makes relationship, what relates you to other people, which makes you feel part of a support group, embedded, have a cultural background, being rooted. So what gives meaning to your life? Everything that cheers you, which is not the same then as just wearing pink glasses and looking at the life always smiling. No, what is to be said and has to be changed, and what is not good shall be addressed as such. But don't disregard the positive that's always there, and make this part of your daily practice to exercise, to be mindful, to eat healthy and mindfully, to meditate or relax, and have an appointment with yourself, and then have an appointment with people that you relate to, that you really love and that love you, and that make good and healthy relationships. And if you do that, you will get all the gains of what biology has provided for us, which is we are not born to become miserable, but we are born to become happy and to live through life fully. And at the end, when it's time to go, to let go. That's the whole thing.
I like the way you wrap that up. I want to switch gears before we close, because you've also written quite a bit about the neurobiology of love. And you talk about love as a complex neurobiological phenomena. And you have also said love has mostly been the domain of artists and poets, a deep beloved mystery. But you have thought of love in scientific terms. Can you define this neurobiological phenomenon for us?
It's quite similar to the happiness concept, that love as happiness are not just concepts. They are mere just psychological things nice to have, right? The same with music, actually. Also, there are people out there that say music is just nice to have. No, we know that music is part of our matrix, of our really machine room. So without love, we would not be here anymore. Love is not just nice or ecstatic, but love is a biological function to have the right people meet and care for each other, make love, produce offspring, care for the offspring, care for the whole thing, and then really care for the whole tribe. So love is the driver that basically produces us being born, going through life, and be able to let go at one point and being cared for. And there are differences between men and women in terms of which neurotransmitters lead to which behavior. Men, for example, at long periods in life being more territorial, so more protective, whereas particularly women and children in certain periods of life are more protecting the core relationship, like skin to skin, like caring for each other. This sounds quite stereotype, I know. So one has to be careful. However, also now studies being out there a couple of years ago, showing that yes, men also produce, of course, oxytocin, for example, which is the paradigm neurotransmitter for the mother-child relationship, like this holy relation that we also feel when we listen to music that really touches us, when we get goosebumps, the same molecule. And yes, men have it too, and fascinating, elderly have it even more than the young, although we always thought this is only the mother and the child. No, elderly have it too. So the love is the almost sacred connection of relating to a person in a very deep and intimate way, on the one hand with a goal of merging and yes, producing offspring, and then on the other side it has this protective quality of the territorial, of really making sure that there is space for the offspring to grow and for acquiring knowledge. And then there is this caring aspect, this taking care for and of someone to make sure that everything that one has acquired during life, wisdom, but also material objects, all that will be given and handed over to the next generation. So love is the core concept of us being here, being able to reproduce, to grow, and to have a future. And because love is so important, it comes in so many ways, in the poems, the arts, and all of that. But it has always, if it comes to the reward system and the brain, it's the hardware there is quite universal. Yeah, it's a biological function. And because it's so critical, it's like the core feeling, one could almost say, like on the other side, fight and flight and having to survive. But everything that is not an immediate threat, the thing that gets us going, that makes us get up in the morning, and then, as we know from studies all over the world, that actually makes a happy life, makes a life full, makes a life a good life. If there's one quality, there are many we know now, but if I had to name just one, then it's good and loving relationship, which is love.
Yeah. And that ramps into happiness too, that deep, meaningful happiness that you were discussing.
Exactly. This becomes then one. At the end, this all falls into one place. This deep happiness that is an inner state that is not so much reliant anymore on the outer, which becomes a state that actually becomes a trait, which means it stays. It does not vanish. And it's more silent. It's more like a smile than like a big awe. That is this, even the romantic love that all this leads to. And at the end, and this type C happiness or whatever you want to call it, love, like true authentic love and happiness become one.
Tobias, I think I need to learn German so I can read all of your books.
Well,
this has been such a great introduction into your ideas and your concepts and your research. And I'm just holding on to everything that you said with gratitude. I feel you need to come on our show again because there's so much more here. But I thank you so much for being with us today. Is there anything additionally that you want to share before we close?
I thank you, Patricia, for inviting me. I just thank you for listening. I'm apologizing for sometimes not really finding the right word. I hope the message I was able to convey. And at the end, in these days, these challenges we all encounter these days all over the world, the idea of crisis is also a moment of growth and that we're all in this together. There is no Ukrainian, no Russian, no US, no German. At the end, I truly believe the core motives why we get up in the morning, what for we get up in the morning, that is all the same. We all share it. So I just wish all the listeners who find this interesting, let's make this place, if not better, then at least a place that we can conserve for the next generations to come. Then they don't have a voice and it's on us. And the good news is we become happier then too.
So well said. Thank you, Tobias.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being with us today. If you read German, his books are on Amazon. If not, there are plenty of research studies that he's authored available on Google. As always, we invite you to check out choosemuse.com and use discount code UNTANGLE15 when you're ready to purchase. If you have comments or suggestions for guests, email me at untangle@choosemuse.com. Have a great week, and we will see you next time.